have in mind sort of the one idea that led me to want to give this course is that I find a lot of people I've talked to over the years want to read Mises. They'll say, well, Human Action is supposed to be the greatest 20th century book in Austrian economics, but then when they try to read it, they find it very difficult, especially the first 100 pages or so. So what I want to do in this course is to try to explain what Mises was driving at, both in Human Action and some of the other works, in a way that you'll find, if I'm successful, easy to understand. I think once you see what Mises had in mind, you'll see it isn't very complicated at all. And in order to understand this, and this will be coming up later in the lecture, there's a misconception that, or some related misconceptions about what Mises was doing that we have to get rid of. And once we get rid of these misconceptions, then we'll see that what Mises was doing in Human Action is really quite simple and straightforward. And that's why I call this first lecture the Common Sense Method of Economics. You'll find it's a very common sense approach to things. Now, Mises, we might think, well, why give a course on Mises epistemology? After all, Mises was an economist. He read a lot of philosophy, as you can see. He'll always quote philosophers, Bergson, Spinoza, all sorts of philosophers. But he isn't a philosopher himself, so why give a course on his theory of knowledge, on his epistemology? And the basic reason for this is that Mises thought, and I think he argued for this very successfully, that economics has an important contribution to make to epistemology, which we said before is the study of how we know. And what he contended was that economics uses a different method from method that's used in the physical sciences. But even though it's using a different method from the physical sciences, it's able to arrive at general laws. So we can see from this that Mises has a view of philosophy, which was quite common when he was writing and also is common today, that a lot of philosophy, especially in the theory of knowledge, consists in trying to understand how science arrives at its results. Say we have a scientific theory, how do we know that the theory of relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity, is true? Or how do we know that Darwin's theory of evolution is true? Some people don't think it's true. How do we arrive at scientific knowledge? So what Mises is saying is, look, philosophers are concentrating almost entirely when they try to answer how does science attain knowledge just on the physical sciences, but that economics is another way we can attain knowledge. We can get general laws through economics. So philosophers should, if we clarify how economics attains knowledge, then we'll be making contribution to philosophy. And just one more preliminary point before I go on with explaining this in detail. I should say what I'll be doing in this course is trying to explain Mises' views, as I say, in a hope in a way that you'll find easy to understand. I won't be primarily concerned with arguing in favor of these views, although I think, as you'll see, there's a great deal to be said in favor of them. We won't be considering too much all sorts of objections to them, although we'll consider them to some extent. What basic idea I have in mind, once more, is to explain what Mises was saying. Then once you understand that, you'll be in a position to be able to evaluate it yourself. Now, if Mises is right, suppose he says, well, economics has an important contribution to make to philosophy, because it has this special way of knowing things. It's different from the sciences. So why is it that philosophers and people write on method in science, study this sort of thing, haven't devoted much attention to economics before Mises? If you go, say, to, you'll find, say, even today, if you look in philosophy of science books, there's been some work on philosophy of economics, but it's not the main topic. People don't really study it as much as some other areas, so why not? And I should say, when Mises is talking about economics, when he says that economics has an important contribution to make to philosophy, it has this method of understanding knowledge that is different from the sciences. When he talks about economics, he doesn't just mean Austrian economics, the kind of economics that he does in Human Action, the kind of economics you'll find in Murray Rothbard or Friedrich Hayek. He has in mind standard price theory. He doesn't think he's making some kind of revolutionary move in describing the method of economics. He thinks he's talking about how economists do economics, the standard way. So if you look at a textbook in price theory, you'll find, at least in non-mathematical parts, you'll find arguments very much like the ones he gives. So he isn't thinking he's coming up with some revolutionary new method of doing economics. He's saying, here's how economics proceeds. This is the standard way we do it, but it's different from the way we do things in the physical sciences. So if we study how we conduct economics, how we carry out economics, we'll come up with these valuable ideas on how we can acquire knowledge, and we'll realize that the standard picture of scientific knowledge, which is based on the physical sciences, has to be expanded. Mises thinks that one obstacle to doing this, one reason people haven't investigated the method of economics in the, to the extent they should, is that many people, including some people go by the name of economists, don't like the idea of strict economic law. Say, in economics, supposedly one of the things we find out if we study economics is that people's wages are determined by their marginal value productivity. So very simply, what your wage will, when you're employed, what your wage will be tend to be determined by how much you contribute to the product, the value of what you contribute to the product. So if we have such a principle, then this suggests that it won't be up to the government to raise people's wages above this. If it tries to do that, it'll have all sorts of consequences that they don't like. So a lot of people don't care for this idea. They don't like the idea that if they want to achieve certain goals, say they want to have a centrally directed economy, they won't like arguments, say, that Mises and other economists make, that you can't have economic calculation under socialism. They don't like it, so therefore they're not going to look favorably to investigations of philosophy that stress the contribution of economics. Now, I should say, when Mises says this, that some people have an interest in opposing economics because it goes against their policy views, this doesn't mean that he thinks that that fact invalidates the objections that these people make to economics. He's very clear, this is a very important point, you should take note of this because it applies far outside economics, that the motives that someone has for advancing a certain view are don't determine whether the person's argument is valid or not. I mean, supposing, I don't think this is right, and supposing somebody rejected economics theory because he liked socialism, but he had some good arguments against certain economic theories, then the fact that his motive was to try to put in socialism wouldn't invalidate his ideas. So Mises is very much aware, he's interested in why people have ideas, why people oppose economics, but he doesn't think pointing that out is sufficient to refute what these other people say. Now, there's, I see a question here. If it's true that many people don't like it, what's their idea of a source of knowledge? Well, that would just vary with the various people. I mean, some people would say the only kind of knowledge you have in scientific knowledge, though, is the kind you get in the physical sciences. They just wouldn't recognize that there is any particular economic knowledge at all, but that would just vary. I should mention that the discipline that studies why people advance particular ideas, there's a 20th century thinker named Karl Mannheim who wrote about this. It's called Sociology of Knowledge. He himself was rather socialistic in his view. If you read Hayek's Road to Serfdom, he has quite a bit to say about Karl Mannheim, but this is a very different view from the one Mises had. Because Mises didn't think that once you've explained where people's ideas come from, then that is all you need to do. You still need to consider the origin. Now, Bill says, if you can ask an offer insight to epistemology, where is that insight? Is that, well, that's what the subject of this lecture is. Just stay with us, and this is what we'll be talking about for the rest of the time. Okay, now, we have to understand, to go to the question Bill has asked, we want to understand, well, what is the contribution that economics makes to epistemology? How does it differ from the physical sciences? Well, in the physical sciences, at least in many of the physical sciences, what we're doing, we're studying matter in motion. We're studying bodies that are moving in various ways, or we're trying to come up with universal generalization. For example, let's take a familiar scientific law, Boyle's law, which is that the pressure and volume of a gas will equal a constant. Let's say if we increase the pressure on a gas, this will compress the gas, this will decrease the volume. If we lighten the pressure, the volume will increase. So if we multiply the pressure times the volume, we'll get a constant. I've just selected this law because it's one of the few scientific laws I've heard of, so I thought it would be a good one to pick. Now, one thing about these laws, such as Boyle's law, they don't make any references to purposes or end. By end, I mean a goal. Suppose that we have an increase in pressure on the gas. We don't say, well, the volume is trying to adjust to the increased pressure by decreasing because the volume wants to maintain this constant K. And it knows that the only way to do that is to reduce itself. So it will reduce itself that way and maintain the constant. That isn't the way the physical sciences work. Yes, that's right. Bill says science does not have free will. That's a good way of putting it. We're just talking about, we see that there's pressure and volume vary inversely, and that's all that we have. We don't attribute any purposes to the pressure volume. So this is quite general in the physical sciences. Now, there's some people who disagree with this idea. There's some philosophers who think that nature does have purposes. Hegel is one who thought that. Aristotle thought that. Aristotle thought, didn't think that, say, physical objects are conscious, but he thought there were non-conscious purposes in objects. But this idea hasn't been used, the notion of final causes is the term philosophy. This hasn't been used since the 17th century in science. Modern science really doesn't use the notion of purposes. It tries to explain things just in terms of matter and motion. Francis Bacon in 17th century said that final causes are useless, like the Vestal Virgins in ancient Rome. So he said, science, we don't use purposes. So Mises certainly rejected any notion of purpose outside of human beings. Possibly animals have purposes to some extent, especially higher animals. That's kind of a difficult case. But when we talk about physical nature, we don't talk about purposes. And this is the essential difference between studying human action and studying physical science, which is just bodies in motion, that people not only move like physical bodies. We could talk of, say, a person being pushed, just like we could talk of a physical object being pushed across the room, push a person across the room. But people also have purposes. They try to achieve goals. And this is just what we mean by action. Action, as Mises takes, the use of means to achieve ends. Say, I want to have a drink of water now, so I reach over, get my cup of water, and drink it. So here, if we're trying to explain what I just did, I would say what I would want to do was to have a drink of water, so I thought that the means to do that would be to take this glass full of water and drink some. So it's a very straightforward, common sense idea. We're acting all the time. Now, someone might object to Mises here if he says, well, human beings act, we use means to achieve ends, so this, if we consider that point, this will enable us to make some contribution to epistemology, because economics studies action. So somebody might say, well, why do we have to have economics to study how purpose relates to knowledge? Doesn't history also study action? History, we're concerned with all sorts of action. Why did Caesar cross the Rubicon in 49 BC? Why did the South secede in 1861? We're always concerned with action history, so why do we have to say the special contribution to epistemology comes from economics? Now, we'll be studying history. Mises had some very important things to say about history, which we'll be studying especially in lecture number 3. But the crucial point here, the special contribution that economics makes to theory of knowledge, to epistemology, is that we don't get general laws from history, but we do have general laws from economics. So the question we have to answer is how is economics able to do this? How, if we can put this kind of a form, how is economics possible? If we're not proceeding the way the physical sciences do, but we're still coming up with general laws. Eric says, I'm not clear the question, methodological dualism not strictly separate when it comes to human beings. I'm not sure why you think it wouldn't be. maybe you could elaborate on that. I'm not getting that right away. Okay, so now we're coming up to one of these trouble spots. One of the things I said leads to trouble. Something we have to understand that people get the wrong idea about this particular thing I'll be explaining, and this they think Mises is very difficult or controversial, and he's not. So, as I say, we see actions all the time. Each of us acts and grasps the action of other people. Say, you now are understanding, I'm sure, that I'm giving a talk. You may think it's not a very good talk, but at least you directly grasp that I'm speaking. Or just as I can see if I look over at this chat, I can see sometimes you ask questions, so I can grasp what you're doing. And this is something that's very straightforward. It isn't some unusual notion that Mises introduced, sort of some kind of thing that's put in, that is some old-fashioned view that's been abandoned by modern thinkers who know math. This is a very obvious idea. People act all the time. And what Mises' basic point is that if we act all the time, we're able to understand action. We can't do that unless we use certain concepts like ends and means. Like we say, you can't understand action, somebody's action, unless you understand what goal, the notion of an end, your goal, and the means to achieve that goal. This is involved in our concept of action. And as I say, now here's the crucial point. This is what one of the ways people misunderstand what Mises is doing. There's nothing mysterious in this notion of saying we have to understand certain concepts in order to understand action. I want to consider the analogy. Supposing you hear people having conversation in a foreign language that you don't understand. You can see they're speaking some language, but you don't know what they're talking about. So, unless you learn the language, you won't understand them. That seems pretty obvious. You won't be able to say, if you hear two people, say you hear Hans Hoppe speaking to someone in German and you don't understand German, you're not going to be able to understand what he's saying unless you learn German. So it's similar. What Mises is saying is action is like that. We can't understand action unless we're aware of these concepts that are involved in the notion of action. We have to have a certain categories to understand action. And otherwise we won't be able to know what people are doing. And in fact, since we do grasp what people are doing, we do this all the time in our daily lives, we do have these concepts. Otherwise we wouldn't be able to understand action. And so what Mises says is these concepts are a priori. Now, a priori is a Latin term from before. You have to grasp them in order to make sense of action. You have to have them before you can understand action. This is the way you understand actions, by having these concepts. Now, this term a priori tends to scare a lot of people off because they'll think, this is some very complicated philosophy. Maybe this involves accepting Kant's philosophy and saying some people don't like Kant or think Kant is all wrong, especially if you read Ayn Rand, her follower Leonard Peikoff, they think Kant is the worst philosophical villain of all time. So they don't, and he talks about a priori all the time, a lot. So I think, if we talk about a priori, this commit to some kind of Kantian philosophy, we don't want to do this. So, but this isn't what we mean. All he means is that we have to have these concepts in order to acquire, in order to understand action. Yes, now Bill says thought is not action. That's right. When Mises is talking about action, I'll be mentioning this later on. Bill is good at anticipating what the rest of the lecture. Action, we're talking about doing things in the world. We're not talking about thinking about things. We're talking about what's going on in the world. So one thing we have to avoid here is when we talk about a priori concepts in the sense I've talked about, that we have to have these concepts in order to understand action. This doesn't mean we have to be born with these concepts. There are some philosophers who think that concepts are innate. That's to say, we don't learn them, we just have them. Or at least, but we don't have to have that. We don't have to hold that view. Think of my example again, where in order to understand people who are speaking a foreign language, we have to learn the language. Say, if you hear, say, Hans Hoppe speaking German, you want to understand what he's saying, you have to understand German. But you can learn the foreign language, you can learn German, you don't have to know it innately. So similarly, if we say we need certain concepts in order to grasp action, it doesn't follow that we have to have these concepts innately. We just have to have them somehow or other. How we get them is another matter. We just have to have them. Now, this gets to one thing I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, what I consider is the basic mistake people make about what Mises is doing. And once we get rid before I get into this, Daniel said, how is learning the category of action possible? Doesn't learning itself presuppose the category of action? Well, this is a very difficult question. I don't think I have a good answer. But one way we can learn things is we can be trained to respond in various ways, and then somehow we pick up the concepts. So we can't, we wouldn't be learning, learning if in a certain sense would presuppose action, but not, we can have certain kinds of training that don't involve having the concepts fully. We can react, we can say, Wittgenstein wrote about that a good deal, but this is a bit, this kind of side issue is a very interesting one on how we get to acquire the concept. But the basic point is somehow we have to get them. I mean, one view is that they are innate. I'm not meaning to reject that, but just that that's not essential to this. Danny would say it would be somewhat of a, wouldn't be specifically Pavlovian response, but it would be somewhat a learned response. That was something Wittgenstein was very big on. But as I said, maybe we can discuss that in the discussion period. I don't want to get sidetracked. I'm very easily sidetracked, so I have to watch myself. So, as I say, Mises thought we can study action, and in order to do that, we have to have these a priori concepts. And when he's talked about a priori concept, he doesn't mean anything philosophically very controversial, just that we have to have these concepts in order to understand action. And he called this study, the study of action, praxeology. I'm sure everybody's heard the term praxeology. One way of defining praxeology is the one Hayek liked. Was, I always put this in all my courses. Hayek was one of my teachers. Hayek called praxeology, defining it as the pure logic of choice, when we're, how we action involves choice, as we'll see a little bit later, choosing between various alternatives. So the pure logic of choice is praxeology. Now, in his earlier work, Epistemological Problems of Economics, he called it, this study, instead of calling praxeology, he called it sociology, but this wasn't such a good term because sociology means something else in the academic world, so he changed the name to praxeology. Now, one fine point to note here that many people miss is that praxeology is the study of action, means a study of action, the science, the discipline that studies human action. It isn't the deductive method that's used in praxeology. Say in praxeology, as I'll be explaining in a little bit, we're taking the concept of action and thinking what that concept involves and kind of saying, making explicit what is involved in what the concept entails. So when we're doing that, it's kind of a deductive method. But that deductive approach isn't praxeology. Praxeology is the science, not the method used in the science. Sometimes people say, refer to praxeology as the method instead of the study. But now we can get to start getting into this basic mistake. I think this is, Jeremiah wants, is action itself a priori? It's the concepts that are a priori. Action is something that's there in the world, but we have the concepts of what we need to have in order to understand action. Yes, I think Anish points out we don't have to make this a Kantian discipline. But this, now let's get to this basic mistake. When we talk about a priori in the way Mises does, what we mean is just what I've said, that we need to have these concepts in order to understand action. A priori doesn't mean mental. Mises is talking about actions that are out there in the world, like I'm speaking, you're listening, I hope, even though I'm sure I put people to sleep, but you're listening. We're doing things, we're out in the world. Some people think that, when we talk about the reason, something like this, what we say, a priori, this means apart from experience. So if it's apart from experience, then it must be about the mind. So then people are really, Mises thinking economics is some kind of discipline that involves just thinking about your own thoughts. And he's trying to just think about his own thoughts and come up with some principles about the world and how could he possibly do that. But that isn't what he's doing. He just means that we have to have certain concepts in order to understand action, and these actions are, as I say, out in the world. And now, to elaborate a bit more on what I consider this basic mistake, you remember, though you've taken some philosophy, well, no, the great philosopher founder in modern philosophy, René Descartes, raised a skeptical problem. He said, supposing I tried to doubt everything that could be doubted, is there something that can't be doubted? So I just throw everything into question. Like he thought we could doubt the existence of the external world. What if we're not really seeing anything? We just are deceived by some malign demon into thinking we're seeing external objects, but we're not. So he thought, well, one thing he can't doubt that he himself is thinking. So then, starting with his own existence, then he tried to deduce all sorts of other things like the existence of God, the existence of the external world. So he what Descartes was doing was just starting from his own thought and just trying to deduce as much as he could from that. He's trying to come up with some starting point that can't be doubted and then just take it from there. Now, this is not, and I repeat, not, this is not what Mises was trying to do. Mises was not starting just from some thought of his own. Mises is taking for granted the existence of the external world and other people. Just like in physics, say we're studying, we're making various measurements, say people are trying to measure the speed of light, and then we're doing various other things. We don't ask the question in physics, well, how do we know there really is an external world? Or similarly, say in anthropology, we don't know, say people are digging up various bones, and say, well, how do we know that there's such a thing as these bones that just aren't ideas in our mind? We don't make such a, we don't throw that into question, that we do that in certain kinds of philosophy. I should say even in philosophy, certain parts of philosophy, we don't raise skeptical possibilities. Say when we're considering ethics, we say, how should we treat other people? We don't raise skeptical worries. Well, how do we know they really are people? This is just something that comes in particular types of epistemology, metaphysics. We can raise such worries, but we don't in this generally do that in science. And so Mises is not, as I say, starting with some kind of skeptical hypothesis and saying, well, one thing I can't doubt is that my own thought, and then I can then go on to deduce economics based on some principle of starting with my own thought. So his question, again, I mentioned this before, but it's essential that we understand it, is that his question is, he's saying, taking for granted, we do understand action. Say, you do understand that I'm speaking, even if you don't agree with what I'm saying, you certainly understand that I'm speaking. Say, given that we understand this, how is this possible? How are we able to understand this? And so sometimes, one reason I've gone over this at some length is, very often people ask me, I get this, you know, I've been lecturing in the Mises University for about 25 years now. People sometimes ask me nearly every time, well, how do we know that the conclusions of praxeology that Mises comes up with apply to other people? So see, this question rests on a false assumption, because it's thinking that in praxeology we're just talking about our own thought, we're talking about our own action, our own thought, but we're not doing that, we're just considering action out in the world. Now, I should say, I just see some question here, some observation, someone suggests that Quine, the great philosopher, W.B.O. Quine, destroyed the analytic synthetic distinction. Well, whether he did that or not, I think that really doesn't affect what Mises is doing, because he's talking about a priori concepts or a priori principles. He just means this in this restricted sense that I'm talking about, that we have to understand these concepts in order to understand action. So that's entirely consistent with what Quine says, whether or not you agree with Quine, but I don't think Quine would have any problem with this. Of course, we can't ask him now, he's no longer with us, but I don't think so. So we can see what's wrong with this mistake. If we look at what Mises says about polylogism, remember in the reading I gave you in the Human Action has some discussion of polylogism, it's an interesting word. Now this is the view that different races or classes have different logics. So in this view, there isn't a single set of a priori concepts that applies to all actions. Say we would have different, say, if say we have a certain set of concepts, they would apply just to one class or race. So on the polylogist view, depending on what the particular variety is, we don't have the same kind of concepts applying. We don't have this universal set of concepts we need to understand any action. For example, if you look at the great book that Oswald Spengler, a great book called The Decline of the West. This is a book Mises discusses in Theory and History. Spengler was one of the great German historian and philosopher of history, who was a precursor of fascism. So he thinks that each culture has a separate way of thinking. So this would be an example of what Mises means by polylogism. So what I want to point out here is, we see how does Mises respond to this. What he says is, well, when we actually look at the different classes or races, or say we look at some people think that primitive tribe or Stone Age tribes have different kinds of logic from the one we do. So when we look at these various class arrays, we'll find that the categories do apply universally. He says we wouldn't be able to understand these actions unless we use this set of concepts, the ones that these a priori categories of action. So he isn't coming up with some kind of just some impossibility proof. He just says, well, look and see what happens if we try to understand actions without, we try to understand what people do without using this concept, we won't be able to do it. So it's very much, you can see it's not a view that starts with just what's going on in his own mind. He's saying, here's actions out there in the world, just try, if you think you don't need these concepts, just try to get along without them, you won't be able to do it. So you can see, I just brought this in, basically, not only because polylogism is important, but just to make this point again, so we avoid this basic error of thinking that Mises embarked in some kind of Cartesian project that's confined to his own mind, and then what has the problem, how do we know this applies universally? Now, I should say, while we're on polylogism, there's a version of polylogism that's popular among contemporary anthropologists. For example, Marshall Solins, who's a very influential anthropologist, cultural anthropologist, who taught at the University of Chicago for a long time. He was following the great French anthropologist, sociologist, Marcel Mauss, who was, Emile Durkheim's nephew. So he claims that economic rationality doesn't apply to Stone Age tribes and to many other societies. And he says these societies aren't based on self-interest, say, when we try to produce as efficiently as possible in order to advance our own interests. He says in these societies, people just give gifts to other people. It isn't based on self-interested calculation. So he said, well, these societies have a completely different way of thinking from modern Western societies. So I don't think he discusses Mises explicitly, but he thinks economists are in error because they think that certain categories just apply to, say, Western man at particular historical periods apply universally. So this type of view really doesn't concern praxeology, because Mises is not saying that everyone is trying to get as much money as possible. He's talking about the structure involved in any action. It, even if there are, even if Solomon is right that there are societies that are based on gifts rather than economic exchange in some kind of limited way where this involves pursuit of self-interest, then we would find that the categories of action still apply to those societies. Of course, there's some question whether Solomon is right about the societies he's describing. So it's something like, to understand what Mises had in mind, it's something like, remember those of you taking my logic class, remember we talked about logical form. We can say if we're talking about a proposition, say we have a proposition, we have, say, subject, copulant, predicate, S is P. So we're not concerned when we're just giving the form that any proposition has to have with the content of the proposition. We're talking about a form that applies regardless of the content of the proposition. So similarly, what we're doing with action, Mises is right, there are certain categories we have to understand action. And this applies regardless of the content of the action. So even if people are trying, that it isn't just actions where people are trying to make as much money as possible or people are just trying to advance themselves. Any action, if Mises is right, has to be explained through these categories. So what we said that there are categories, there are certain constants, these a priori concepts that we need to understand action. So well, what are some of them? Well, first we have that sort of the definition of an action is that every action uses means to achieve an end. And when Mises says this, he's not limiting action to carefully thought out actions. Suppose you just wake up in the morning and you kind of reach out and turn off your alarm clock, you're not really giving much thought, but you're doing that, that counts as an action. It's, you had a goal, it doesn't have to be something you thought about, but your action can be explained by saying you had the goal of turning off the alarm clock, so that's why you reached out and banged on top of the clock. So again, I've gone over this a number of times, but I want to keep going over it because people always have this misconception. We're talking about action, what's going on in the world, not just in your mind. So habitual behavior counts as action. It's not just things we're thinking about. And so does behavior explained by Freud's psychology. Supposing someone has one of the famous Freudian slips and psychoanalyst says, oh, the reason the person made this slip is that this he's expressing some kind of there's some kind of unconscious conflict that he's expressing by this Freudian slip. So Mises would count this as an action, he would count unconscious action, talk about Freudian unconscious as action. As long as you can use ends and means to the categories of ends and means to explain what's going on, you have an action. Of course, you don't have to accept Freud's psychology. It is just an example. Mises himself knew Freud and he was very sympathetic to psychoanalysis. So I'm mentioning this not to defend or to Freudian psychoanalysis, but just to indicate how broad the concept of action is that Mises is talking about. Now, Mises makes a very controversial claim. He says that what seems to be very controversial, all action is rational. But what he means by this, it turns out it isn't controversial. All he means is that uses means to achieve an end. Now, he doesn't mean that all action is rational in other senses. Say, one example, what we could call a type of irrational action, say somebody makes a mistake in reasoning. People make mistakes in reasoning all the time. And so Mises certainly isn't saying that people don't make mistakes in reasoning. So see, that there's a, probably a lot of you are familiar with a discipline called behavioral economics that studies various kinds of mistakes or irrationalities in people's actions. So regardless of the results of that discipline, that isn't in conflict with what Mises is saying, because he just means that people are using means to achieve ends. They can choose means that will fail to achieve their ends, although they mistakenly think that they will do so. Supposing I think, say, there's someone I don't like, and I think that I can cause harm to this person by making a little doll of him and sticking pins in that. So one could say, well, I haven't chosen, assuming that wouldn't work, I probably, maybe it would, what do I know? But supposing it wouldn't, I haven't chosen a very good means to achieve my ends, but I'm still rational in the way Mises is understanding this, because I'm using a means to achieve an end, at least I think at the time I'm doing it, this means will achieve the end, so that explains why I'm doing that. So that's all Mises means when he's talking about, says that all action is rational. Now here, I want to I see there's been some discussion here between Bill and some other people. It sounds like, just looking at his comments, Bill is very sympathetic to Ayn Rand's philosophy. This is something, well, I hope you'll stay around for lecture number 4, because we'll be discussing Mises and Rand in that one. So on this point where Mises said that all action is rational, he had a very different approach from that of the great German sociologist Max Weber, who was his friend, incidentally. So Weber, Mises discusses this particular point in Epistemological Problems of Economics. Weber distinguished 4 types of action. He said there's purposive rational, valuational, effective, and customary traditional. Now, purposive rational would be something like, suppose a businessman wants to make a profit, so he opens a business and then starts having bookkeeping and tries to have his profit exceeds his costs. That would be an example of purposive rational action. You're doing something for a conscious purpose, you're calculating. But valuational would be something like, you hold that something is of intrinsic value. Say, imagine you're going to follow certain religious practices because you think it's intrinsically valuable that you do those things. And effective would be you're doing something because you're guided by emotion. Say, you're in love with someone, so you buy her all sorts of presents. That would be an example of effective action. Then customary traditional, say you do certain things just because that's the way your society does things. This is the custom. Why do you bow when you meet the queen? Well, it's just the custom to do that. Well, I see Bill knows all the Randian ideas. That would be what the Randians would say. But you see, what I'm concerned with now is not whether the notion of intrinsic value makes any sense, but it's just that this is what Weber was talking about. Whether he was right or not is something else. But Weber, as I say, confined this rational action to this first type, so this calculating action. an ideal type is something we'll be talking about in the third lecture, but basically an ideal type is an abstraction that doesn't completely apply to the world. We just say construct, imagine somebody who has motives of a particular kind, and then just use that, say we imagine, say, somebody who's dominated entirely by trying to make as much money as possible. So then we have this kind of an ideal type. Even if there aren't such people, we just imagine that there are and use that as a tool to explain things. So Weber thought that rational action was just an ideal type, just a certain type of behavior taken as an abstraction, kind of calculating behavior. Nobody is calculating all the time. It's just an ideal type. But Mises said, no, the way he's using rational action, it's universal. We're always acting rationally because we're always, in any action, it's using means to achieve an end. I'll give you, just to finish up with, some examples. Say what we're doing, we have the concept of action, use means to achieve an end. So what we're trying to do is think about what's involved in this concept. And I'll give you some examples of what Mises comes up with. Well, he says, an action involves what he calls felt dissatisfaction. Why are you acting? Say, because you're not satisfied with the existing state of affairs, or probably more exactly the state of affairs that would exist if you didn't act. Say, why did I decide to give this lecture? It's because I preferred doing that. I was dissatisfied with state of affairs while I wasn't giving the lecture at this time. I wouldn't be getting paid if I didn't give my lecture. So I'm acting because I'm not satisfied with the state of affairs. I don't give a lecture, so that's why I'm acting. Now, this doesn't imply that things will always get better, even if you don't regret your actions. Say, you know, you could think of a case where somebody is dissatisfied and think that doing such and such will improve things, but it turns out that he was wrong. And supposing that he's right, he thinks things will, this action will make things, but it doesn't follow the overall situation is always improving for you. It could just it be that your action is better, it's just that your action will be better than if you hadn't acted, even if your overall condition is worse. And you would think things are really getting bad, but doing this will slow down the decline, so then that's still you're acting to make things better, but you're not guaranteed that just if your action is successful, that your overall situation will just keep improving. Okay, now another basic truth about action is that all action involves choice. We always have different goals we could choose. And what we do when we have these various goals or ends we could pursue, we choose the end that we rank highest at the time. And how do we know this? Well, we just think about it. Is that true? Would it make sense to say somebody chose to do something, but he really wanted to do something else? Then we could say, well, if he really wanted to do something else, and he pick that highest, why did he choose what he did? Why didn't he choose the other thing? Now, sometimes people could object to this. There are cases, what they called in philosophy, weakness of will. Let's imagine, say, I'm not a smoker, but imagine I was. Suppose I value the goal of, I say I value the goal of reduced risk of lung cancer higher than the pleasure I get from smoking, but I smoke anyway. Now, what would Mises say about that? Well, you could certainly have a case where whenever you smoke, you regret right afterwards that you smoked, or you could have imagined you wish you didn't like smoking as much as you do. But if you take literally that, the this couldn't be right. You couldn't really say literally when the person is smoking, he prefers to do something else. At the time he's smoking, he prefers smoking. It might be right afterwards. He's sorry about it. He didn't smoke because he's thinking about it. Might get increased chance he got lung cancer. But while he's choosing, then he's choosing what he most prefers. And so Mises rejects what philosophers, I shouldn't have had an apostrophe there, stupid, call strong akrasia. Akrasia is just a Greek term for weakness of will. So if there's a view that you could prefer, all things considered, a particular time to do something, then do something else. So Mises said, no, if we think about concept of action, this won't make sense. Now, another principle that Mises says we'll come up with if we think about what's involved in action, what he calls methodological individualism. And this is the principle that only individuals act. So if we talk about a collective entity, such as a class and nation, they act only through the individuals out of which they're composed. So if we say something like, Germany invaded Russia in 1941. That means that certain people, say Hitler, decided he was going to invade Russia and gave orders to various people, and as a result of that, troops from Germany crossed the border into Russia and invaded them. It wasn't, the country isn't acting apart from the individuals that are composing it. I should say, you know, one of my favorite humorists, Oscar Levant, once said, he wondered why is it we can say Germany invaded Russia or Hitler invaded Russia, but we don't say Germany invaded Stalin or Hitler invaded Stalin. Kind of interesting linguistic curiosity. So one point about methodological individualism is that this view doesn't deny that nations or classes exist. It isn't an eliminativist view. It isn't saying, well, there isn't any such thing as Germany or the United States. They're just individuals. It's just saying that the nation, if we talk about the nation acting, it's only through individuals who are acting. It's not denying that nations or classes exist. And the last thing I'll mention is how do we know that, gone over this a little bit before, but just to sum up, how we know that these various claims about action, others that Mises makes in Human Action, other words, are true. His answer is, when we think about the concept of action and what it involves, so his idea is that we have this concept of action, we know these categories, but what we're trying to do is to make explicit what we already implicitly know. So these results, these theorems of praxeology, these theorems of the pure logical choice, aren't arbitrary postulates. They're things we'd find out by thinking about the concept of action. And we know that they're not arbitrary because once we've got them, they enable us to make sense of action. So again, we just talk about what's out there in the world, here are all these action, and by using these categories, this is how we make sense of it. So I think we'll stop there, and so the rest of the time we can have questions or comments, objections. Let's see, E.T., wasn't that a character in a movie? If human action presupposes causality, it is not ruled by teleology, can we say that human actions do not have time-invariant causes, that we cannot trace back human action to causes, we can only trace them forward to ends, therefore we can't use probability theory? Well, I think in explaining an action, yes, we wouldn't, I think you're right, we wouldn't be explaining the action by causes in the sense that's used in the physical sciences. We would always have to make reference to the end that the person is it has in mind. Now, whether the con now, however, I don't know that we can rule out just from praxeology. It might be that there are causal accounts of why particular people choose, they explain why particular people choose particular ends. I don't think that can be ruled out a priori. It's not, certainly not used in praxeology. Now, Justin said, I undersold Ramses Lycurgus, she referred to him as the most evil man in history. Yeah, yes, I mean, she did have that view. You know, if you look at, Peikoff has a book called Ominous Parallels, where he really traces the rise of Nazism to the influence of Kant's philosophy and what he regards as a kind of corrupting effect on thought, kind of irrationalist view of thought. I hope, you know, I should just mention, I hope at some time in future to give a course on philosophy of Ayn Rand where I could go into some of these things. Jeremiah says, Mises makes an argument for the invalidity of the trans law of inequality regards to preferences. Jeremiah wants to know, this argument is the root of majority of errors in social sciences. I think you're entirely right that Mises doesn't use transitivity of preference. He says this isn't something we can follow from praxeology. Transitivity of preference is something like, if I prefer, I shouldn't have this set of preferences, A over B, B over C, and C over A. But when I say I like vanilla ice cream better than chocolate and chocolate better than strawberry, or I like strawberry better than vanilla, that would be an example of intransitive preferences. But I don't think, I'm not seeing why that would be the root of the majority of errors in social sciences. I want to see how you would, where you would go with that. I mean, I'm not really seeing what this, I mean, some people think that, some people think that transitivity is a requirement of rationality in Mises, is the way Mises is using it. It isn't. I mean, you can show it, you can show sometimes if you reject transitivity and people could get into difficulties in certain ways, but there's some controversial arguments there. You know, if you one way you could get in difficulty if you reject transitivity is that you can make if somebody can make bets with you and you'll lose money if in a certain way. I won't go into it now, but you can by making certain bets with somebody has intransitive preferences, you can make him lose his money. But then that argument's controversial because what if the person just has intransitive preferences but won't take these bets? Now, Anish once says, oh, yes, on probability theory. Yes, that is right. That's an interesting paper. Yes, and Danny says he didn't agree with Kantian view of socialism. Yes, what Mises discussed in book Socialism, there's a particular school of neo-Kantians were headed by the great neo-Kantian Hermann Cohen. I'll put him down here. He was one of the great late 19th, early 20th century Kantian philosophers. And he was a socialist. And Mises argued against him, but Mises rejected sort of this kind of neo-Kantian socialism, but he held, he was very influenced by Kant in his theory of knowledge. Now, Jeremiah, before we have a few before Jeremiah, E.T., if you could trace back human action time and variant causes, and therefore use probability theory to predict them, then are we free? First of all, it wouldn't follow if you could trace the human action back to causes that you would necessarily be able to predict action. But the answer there, I think, would all depend on what you meant by being free. I mean, you could have a sense in which you could have a sense in which people are free in the sense they're doing what they choose, but it's still the case that there are laws that govern their behavior. It's just that if they chose in a different way, there would be a different set of laws governing their behavior. It isn't that the laws are, we wouldn't be thinking of the laws kind of forcing them to do a certain thing. It would just be whatever they chose to be, there would be some set of laws explaining, some set of laws under which their action could be subsumed, but it wouldn't follow that these laws are constraining them. Bill says errors are social or epistemological and may conceive an ideal world is told outside the existing. Yes, I think sometimes people do raise these unreal possibilities. Well, sometimes it might be useful to consider possibilities that don't actually exist. I know in the Randian view, they tend to not like that too much. Now, Bill says action is not predetermined. I think, Bill, it depends what you mean by invariant cause. I mean, if you mean something like a cause that would be operate regardless of what the person chose, then I think you're right. I mean, one wouldn't have to consider causes of that kind. Anish wants to know something about evolutionary psychology. Well, I mean, I think what the evolutionary psychologists are concerned with is rather a different notion of categories than from what the one we're talking about here. These would be certain biological, I think what they're talking about is certain kind of biological categories, say people act in certain pattern ways, and it's claimed as a result of evolutionary biology. But the categories we're talking about here are ones that we need to understand action. So that might be one way, what the evolutionary psychologists talk about, that might be one view as to how we could acquire such concepts or how we're predisposed to acquire them. But the Mises account doesn't presuppose or depend on the success of this evolutionary account. It's more just saying, regardless of how we acquire these concepts, we have to have them in order to understand action. Now, Mike says, is it true that preferences are demonstrated only by action? Can preferences be known in any other way than through the actions taken based on? It's right that what we're concerned with in Rothbard is actions that are demonstrated. But it doesn't follow from that that we can't talk about preference other than what the action is, because the person himself who acts will be aware of various alternatives that he might have done. So suppose I say, well, I could have, instead of giving, say, before I gave this lecture, I could have decided to take an afternoon, I could have taken a nap instead of lecturing. I could have gone out and had some birthday cake. Today's my birthday. I expect presents from everybody instead. So I could have, I have these various alternatives. So, I mean, I would be in, those would be examples of preferences that I might have, or things that would be on my scale, preferences that I didn't do, but I mean, they would certainly be there. There are people who kind of think, well, you can't really strictly talk about a preference unless it's something that you actually do. But I don't think, I don't agree with that view. Then it's just saying you always choose your most highly valued preference, really just saying you always choose what you choose. Thank you, Dan. But I'm an old man now. I was an old man even before, but I'm even older. I think if you just say action, there's no preference apart from action, then you just say, you just choose your most highly valued preference. You just choose whatever you choose. I don't think that's really useful. Matthew says, in National Foundation media said, what is Mises by saying imposed upon us by the world in which we live and act, which we want to study? Well, I don't think imposed probably isn't the best word to use, but I think what he means by this is that, just what I was talking about in the lecture, that we use these concepts in order to understand reality. Say an example he gives, I'll be discussing this a bit in my next lecture, is that supposing, say, we drop an object and find it falls, so we tend to know that certain heavy objects will fall down to the earth, then we have an assumption that we use of regularity. We say, well, it isn't just I dropped this object, it fell, so then next time I drop a similar object, I don't know, it might go up, it might go off to the side somewhere. We assume that if we do have a same type of cause, we'll have the same effect. We have a regularity assumption. So if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be really able to make sense of the physical world. So this is, I think, what Mises is getting at. Now, Bill says, it says, reality is what it is. It's up to us to understand the facts as they reduce the rule of action. That's a Randian way of taking things. It's not quite what it's not quite the way Mises would put it, but that is a kind of a Randian approach to things. I should say, Bill, am I right that you're quite a convinced objectivist? Oh, good. Yes, I thought that. Yes, well, why not? Yes, I mean, now that's an interesting one. Bill suggests there's not much difference between Mises and Rand. That's something we'll be looking at in lecture number 4. That's a very interesting, I mean, there's certainly areas of similarity. I'm inclined to think there's some differences also, but that's one thing we'll consider. Yes, I think you're right that there are differences on epistemology, and there are other differences. Well, I mean, that's something we'll look into. I don't want to jump the gun and go into lecture number four now. Errol says, can you point us some material to read on Mises, Weber, relationship disagreement? Well, I think the basic thing you should look at first is chapter in Epistemological Problems of Economics. I think chapter two in the section that I assigned you reading on sociology. And I should say, one thing I like about Epistemological Problems of Economics in the English translate, the one issued by the Mises Institute that you'll be able to look up, I like the index very much. I recommend the index. Danny asked, do you think Hoppe's argumentation-based epistemology takes the Misesian project to be more of a Cartesian project? Well, that's interesting. I think he does, I would say this, he does tend to take Mises as coming up with some sort of justification of knowledge as such, not just of action. But I wouldn't say it's Cartesian in the sense it's starting from just what's going on inside someone's mind. I think Hoppe is taking action, as Mises understands, to be some kind of foundation for our knowledge of everything, just like mathematics or physics. Paul Lawrence, he talks about proto-physics and proto-mathematics. So I think he's taking Mises kind of a broad, makes it have a broader project than one I'm talking about. But I wouldn't say it's strictly Cartesian. E.T. says, couldn't prove can't, don't have causes. Now, E.T. says,
if you said something like, well, suppose I don't want to use time invariant in the sense, I think what you're, if you mean that something would have the same cause regardless of what the person chose, then I think you would get into difficulty. And you said, look, I'm choosing to give a speech, not to give a speech by right now, but I'm physically caused to give a speech regardless of how I chose, then we get into problems. But if we just said something like my action is caused, then I don't think you get into this problem you're raising. Because the problem you're raising, suppose I say my action is caused, then isn't my statement my action is caused also caused? But that's quite consistent with my making the statement, because I think there are good reasons for it. It's only if you assume that the cause is operating regardless of what I take to be the reasons that you get into this kind of problem. Mike wants to know, why are most philosophers so opposed to this a priori approach? One thing is, I'll be getting into this a bit in my second lecture, a lot of philosophers are very influenced by the model of the physical sciences, and they think that knowledge has to be based in this way, and they're model of physical sciences, and they say, well, physical sciences don't use this a priori notion, so we should be careful about that. And another argument that's very influential, sometimes people say, well, there's no, this, again, we'll be discussing this in the next slide, there's no way to test these a priori hypothesis theorems. If you say, well, here's the results of a priori reasoning, what if somebody says, no, I don't accept that? What are you going to do then? So they say, you have to test things out experimentally. That's one. Now, Errol says, argumentation is subsets of human action. That's interesting. I don't know that I want to agree or disagree. That's physics MB. Yes, that's a good term. Okay, I thought I went off, but I didn't. Okay, we have a few more minutes. Justin says, like some people are bored, people are interested. Well, that's a very interesting question. I think it's hard to answer. I think just some people have a kind of a turn of mind for that sort of thing, and others don't. I mean, one thing I would suggest is this. Very often in philosophy, the questions, we keep discussing the same questions. So some people say, well, they don't like puzzles. They don't like to be puzzled by things. They like, well, here's the answer to something. Say you measure the speed of light. That's what it is. They don't like worrying about, well, what is the nature of cause? We're going to have all sorts of conflicting answers that are hard to figure out. They want a definite answer. This is how it is, and they don't like puzzlements. They don't find things puzzling. So I think that's one point. Now, let's see, Danny says, is Rothbard's action, axiom or action different? Let me just see this. Let me see now. Dan is suggesting that saying that humans act is saying, according to saying acting beings are acting beings, and wouldn't be really saying anything. That's interesting, but I don't think we would, it might very well be that if some being didn't act, we wouldn't call it human, but I don't think it follows from that, at least I'm not seeing that it does, that human is to be defined as actor. I mean, it might just be that the two concepts designate the same set of entities, but that doesn't follow, they're identical in meaning. I mean, human seem to be more designating member of a certain species, and we're saying every member of that species has the property of being an actor. So I don't think, I wouldn't be prepared to say it's a pleonasm. Yes, well, that's it. I think action is purposeful behavior. I think that is something like it's defining action. Yes, well, I see we're about out of time now, so I want to thank everybody for coming to the lecture. I hope you'll all come back the next time. And next time we'll be going into some criticisms of the historical, German historical school and the logical positivist raised against Mises and his responses to them. And thanks to everybody for coming to the lecture. Thank you. Thanks everybody. Bye.